Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Marshall Poe, your host. Each week we pick a new history book that we find particularly interesting, and we interview the author of that book. This week I'm very pleased to say we have David Chiarlo on the show, and we'll be talking about his award-winning book, Advertising Empire, Race and Visual Culture in Imperial Germany. If you were born and raised in the United States, you probably know who Aunt Jemima is. Aunt Jemima is an icon, so to say, that is used to sell pancake syrup and pancake mix. Those of you familiar with the history of images of African Americans will know that Aunt Jemima is a mammy. That is a symbol of a kind of safe, subdued domesticity. The mammy will take care of you and will never threaten you. Now, these images, if they're not overtly racist, which they probably are definitely racialized. That is, they involve the creation of stereotypes about certain kinds of people. And these stereotypes appeal to, in this case, white Americans who want to be taken care of by a mammy. I mean, after all, pancakes are a kind of comfort food, and the mammy will give them to you, and Jemima will give them to you. I grew up with this image. You can still find it in a very different form on the shelves of American grocery stores. What I did not know was that images such as this, although different in meanings, could be found in Imperial Germany, that is late 19th, early 20th century Germany. And they had somewhat similar origins. Aunt Jemima came from the culture of minstrel shows, and the German images did as well. But in the German case, they also came from the German experiment with imperialism and colonialism in Southwest Africa. Well, advertisers who already had images of Africans in their kit used this colonial connection to further expand the image of the African in German advertising and culture. These African stereotypes were used to sell primarily tobacco and cocoa and coffee. They were very highly racialized, if not overtly racist, which they probably were. Well, David does a terrific job of telling us what these images meant for Germans and where they came from and where they went after Imperial Germany became the Weimar Republic and then Nazi Germany and so on. It's a really terrific read. I really enjoyed talking to David today, and I think that you'll enjoy the interview. So without further delay, here it is. Hi, David.
Hi, Marshall.
How are you today?
I'm doing great. How are you doing?
I'm glad to hear that. Today we have David Chiarlo on the show, and we'll be talking about his terrific new book, Advertising Empire, Race and Visual Culture in Imperial Germany. One of the things I really liked about this book is that it does focus on images, and it doesn't exactly try to read those images in the absence of other evidence. And I think historians and social scientists in general do a little bit too much of this. They try to figure out what images mean without reference to who produced them or why they were produced or what sort of practical end that the producers of them had in mind. But David does a great job of contextualizing these things and tells us exactly who produced them and exactly why they produced them and why they chose the parts they did. And so we can actually give a really good reading of them. We really do know a lot about what they meant to the people who created them and what message those people were trying to send. And I think that's exactly how this sort of work should be done. It's not really guesswork. It's, in fact, a lot of detective work, and David does a great job of it. So anybody who's interested in visual culture, I think, will really, really enjoy this book. And anyone interested, obviously, in the history of something like advertising, the history of empire, and the history of late Imperial Germany. David, why don't you begin the interview by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Sure thing, Marshall. And let me start by saying thank you for the praise about the book. And also thank you so much for having me on this program.
Sure. My pleasure.
So I'm originally from Colorado. I was born in Colorado. I grew up here. I went to an inner city high school. And people always ask me with my Italian sounding last name how I ended up interested in Germany. And it's really actually sort of almost by accident. I wanted to take a language. My public high school had three languages, Spanish, French, and German. Spanish was for the jocks. I wasn't a jock. French was for the theater majors. I wasn't a theater major. So that left me with German. Uh-huh. And I took it. I wasn't particularly good at it at first, but I stuck with it. And I stuck with it all the way through college. I went to Oberlin College. I was a history major. Mm-hmm. But I took mostly British history at the undergrad level. But I stuck with German. And it wasn't until I traveled to Germany after college in one of those sort of, month-long money poor but experience rich sort of travel experiences that that German really clicked for me as a language. And it was a perfect time to be in Germany. It was 1990, just after the wall came down. Mm-hmm. I traveled around East Germany. I traveled around a little bit around Eastern Europe as well, but spent a lot of time in Germany. It was a really exciting time. And then I came back from that, worked in the corporate world for a while, and then decided I worked for a sporting goods company as sort of a problem solver, and then decided I wanted to go back to graduate school. So I went and got a master's degree in history from the University of Cincinnati. And my a rather amazing mentor there, Maura O'Connor, she got me interested in the more cultural side of history. And then after that, I took a little detour. You can tell the book tends to take a few detours. I think my life took a few detours as well. I went to Zimbabwe, and I lived in Zimbabwe in Harare for a year, working for a local grassroots human rights organization, ZimRights. And I helped to edit their newspaper, which is one of the few independent newsletters at the time that was not run by ZANU-PF, the ruling party of Zimbabwe. And that experience there definitely, it was life-changing in all sorts of ways, but it was also intellectually changing as well. And that was what really got me focused and interested in imperialism as not just a legacy that I saw every day in Zimbabwe, but also as a historical phenomenon. And then I returned to grad school, entered the PhD program at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, had wonderful advisor in Rudy Koshar, and great mentors as well with Suzanne Dasan in French history and Laird Boswell as well. Finished up the dissertation. I taught for a few years at MIT. I taught for several years at the University of Cincinnati. And then now I'm happily ensconced back in Colorado at the University of Colorado Boulder.
Oh, that's very nice. It's kind of like a fairy tale story. You wandered around and wandered around and found your way home.
Exactly. I've been desperate to get back to Colorado my entire life, and here I am. So it's pretty amazing.
Yeah, I wander around and wander around and never find my way home. That's a different story. In fact, I'm getting ready to move again now. I mean, I don't know what's going on with me. But so tell us how you came to write Advertising Empire. How did you choose the subject and pursue it? Because it is a little bit unusual. I think if a PhD student of mine came to me and said, yo, I'm going to write a book about advertising and images, I'd be like, maybe.
Well, I sort of like my life. I sort of stumbled into it. It was definitely, I knew I wanted to do my research on something having to do with imperialism. And again, this traces right directly back to my experiences in Southern Africa. In fact, when I was living in Zimbabwe, a friend and I took a vacation to Namibia, and sort of the dumb idea on my part was to hitchhike there. And so we hitchhiked across the Caprivi Strip.
Yeah, a vacation to Namibia. Let's just say that sentence again, okay? Because I don't think most people are thinking, yeah, Namibia.
And our,
but maybe they should. I don't know.
It was incredible. It was one of the most incredible things ever done. Our guidebook says absolutely, absolutely never do this, because only UN relief convoys go across the Caprivi Strip, and they're not allowed to give you a ride. But we actually found a ride fairly easily on the back of an overland company that was bringing Danish tourists into the Okavango Swamp. So we rode on the top of their supply truck. It was a pretty amazing experience. We wound up, after this long, many days journey, we wound up at Swakopmund on the small town on the coast of Namibia. And it had originally been the port for the original colony of German Southwest Africa. Mm-hmm. And there's still a German-speaking community there.
Really?
Definitely. And we had, Zachertorte and good German beer. And, it's really this vestige of German colonialism, and there's not that many of them left. Wow. Tsingtao beer in China being one of them. But but what I was really struck with, and so there are all these sort of physical manifestations of German colonialism, like a giant pier and whatnot. What I was really struck with there was the tourists. There were tons of German tourists, and especially a lot of tourists from the former East Germany, who were really interested in sort of reconnecting somehow with this former colony of Germany. And that stuck with me. And so when I was studying my, for my prelims and was working on my dissertation prospectus, I knew I wanted to write about imperialism, colonialism in German culture somehow, and sort of the legacy, the imprint of that. And, I read a lot of there wasn't much being done at that time in German imperial culture, but there had been a lot done in British culture. They did a lot of comparative reading. And then when I went to Germany, I buried myself in the archives, and I dug through the records of the German Colonial Office, the records of the German Colonial Society, which the German Colonial Society is sort of like a pro-colonials pressure group, kind of like the NRA, but instead of opposing gun legislation, they're pushing for a colonial acquisition. And I buried myself in these archives, and I researched all their various activities, their publications, which there are a huge volume of publications, their festivals, their evening lectures, their Bierabend, you know, sort of the cocktail hour, right? Mm-hmm. And so I had a good sense of the way this organization was trying to sort of build up a culture of, I guess you call it manly colonialism, and kind of built around the idea of national necessity, that Germany needed colonies, and trying to bring this colonial idea to the German public. And that's sort of their motivating ethic. And I was looking at sort of their cultural imprint, like what sort of things were they doing? How did other Germans see what they were doing? But this left me, I mean, I actually researched this probably for 6, 7, 8 months. But I was a little bit unsatisfied with it, in part because it felt like, to put it bluntly, like these German colonists were trying too hard. I mean, they were trying to get something almost unnatural, a little bit forced about their cultural productivity. They're always stressing, you know, their duty to support their colonial rule, you know, buy, you know, only genuine German colonial products because it's your duty as a German. And it felt kind of unnatural. It felt kind of forced, actually. But still, I was very, you know, I was going that direction. And then there was a complete chance finding. I was in the old German State Library, and for some reason, I stumbled across this catalog reference to this book, Wahrenzeichen Humor, which translates as trademark humor.
Mm-hmm.
And it was published in 1917, height of the First World War. Not sure what made me order it, but I did. I open it up. I find the entire thin book on you know, pretty beat up paper because of the, you know, the limitations on paper in the first one. And there's reprints of funny advertisements from the previous decade, and a number of them are startlingly racist.
Mm-hmm.
One particular one that I remember features an elephant, and it's an advertisement for fasteners, and the elephant is trying to pull a fastener off the ground. And it's ripping its own trunk off, and blood is spurting out of the trunk.
Mm-hmm.
And there's an African figure next to it, an incredibly vicious caricature of this African, you know, showing you know, with huge lips and wide eyes, and it's something that would definitely not be PC by today's standards. And he's showing shock at the trauma of the elephant. Yeah. So these funny ads then really grabbed my attention, and then I noticed that each one had a 6-digit number below it. And so I figured out that this was a trademark registration number. So I traced down where these registrations are collected, and I ordered the first book from 1911. It arrives, 3 massive volumes, each over 1,000 pages. Each one has 5 to 8 advertisements on it.
Mm-hmm.
And so it turned out that German advertisers were registering their ads as trademarks, mm-hmm. trying to give these trademarks some form of copyright protection. And I just started flipping through page after page, all of these advertising images, and I was immediately struck by how many figures of Africans there were, and how all of these African figures looked exactly the same. They were caricatured, they were diminished, they were racialized, and with exaggerated lips, big wide eyes, you know, emphasis on, you know, short stature, deformed bodies, kinky hair, and they all were racial, and they all looked exactly the same.
Mm-hmm.
And then I ordered a volume earlier, just because, you know, a historian, I'm always thinking in terms of change over time. And the volume I got from the mid-1890s, it was the one that came next, and the images were all over the place. They were much more amateurish, but there were a much greater variety mm-hmm. of images. There were some that I would call, you know, romanticized images of blacks. There were, you know, sort of ethnographic images. I mean, the pictographic techniques were all over the map.
Mm-hmm.
And that made me think, how do you get from there to there? How do you get from the 1890s to 1910?
Mm-hmm.
And I was also, I knew in German colonial history at this point, I know that you know, I'd done some research on the Herero uprising and the genocide of the Herero that took place in 1905, 1906. And it struck me, why is it that at the same time that the German military is pursuing, you know, a war in Southwest Africa against the Herero, and a war that, you know, von Trotta and other, you know, German generals are calling a race war, why is it at the same time they're pursuing a genocidal policy against Africans, African figures are being used increasingly to advertise products back in Germany? And that makes much sense to me. So that's the sort of the long, I'm sorry, this is going on and on here, that's sort of the long trajectory where I ended up. And when I started to do the, when I started to realize that these advertising registrations were a gold mine, then I had to sort of reinvent myself as a historian of advertising. I came very late to the game, actually. It was the sources that sucked me into it. And so I did everything. I then, you know, started going to museums and digging through collections of advertising ephemera and product packaging. And I, you know, started reading all the advertising trade journals from the time period. And I was trying to find the smoking gun. You know, I was trying to find the passages by advertisers that would talk about, you know, yes, there's this war going on in Southwest Africa, and so if you're using a black figure, you need to. I never found that. Mm-hmm. And instead, what I found was, just like the colonialists were trying too hard, the advertisers were trying too hard in some ways. They were trying to always portray themselves as tasteful, mm-hmm. As professionals, as people who had, you know, they had one hand or, you know, sort of their finger on the pulse of the most modern current trends that were coming from the United States and coming from Great Britain. But on the other hand, they had their feet firmly planted, you know, in German culture. And that they were, you know, trying to, they were artists as much as they were sort of commercial entrepreneurs.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, when you started on this project, I just have a kind of, it's a related question, I guess. And when you started this, it had to have occurred to you that we have similar sorts of images in American history. And I'm thinking particularly of Aunt Jemima and Uncle Remus and Uncle Ben. These are commercial icons for different kinds of foods.
Right.
Did you make the association immediately? Did you think, this is the German version of that? Or, I mean,
this is the crazy thing is I didn't.
Oh, really?
The association I made, of course, is, you know, there's fantastic work done in British imperial culture, you know, starting with Mackenzie's, you know, book, you know, Propaganda and Empire, and looking at the sort of the popular culture. I saw some of these advertising images, like the famous Pear soap ad, that has the inscription "Pear soap in the Sudan" carved on a rock, mm-hmm. and all the dervishes, the Sudanese dervishes, are worshiping this soap slogan. So I was very familiar with the British side of things, but actually I was remarkably ignorant about the American side of things. And it's interesting, as I was digging in this research, I was telling my mother about it, and my mother grew up, you know, she moved me to Colorado, she moved to Colorado before she had me, but she grew up in the South, in Little Rock, Arkansas. And so she's the one who actually was telling me about all of these, you know, now it's like kitschy collectibles, but, you know, incredibly racist ephemera that was really so much part of, you know, sort of her childhood growing up.
Yeah, yeah. No, I remember very well. I'm originally from Alabama, and then my family moved to Kansas. And, you know, Aunt Jemima was part of my family as far as I knew. And, you know, I don't think I ever had real maple syrup until I was about 30. And that was syrup, you know.
I remember the dancing Aunt Jemima figure.
Yeah, right.
By that time, you know, that's
cake mix. It
was much more, you know, sort of sanitized and much more PC.
It was. It's true, it was, but I recognize it. And from watching old movies, I also recognize the stereotype of a mammy.
Yes.
You know, because everybody watches Gone with the Wind, and there's a mammy in Gone with the Wind. And so these associations were pretty clear to me. When I picked up your book, I thought of those things pretty immediately. But it strikes me that they're actually very, very different in a way, because in America, this there's a kind of wistful, elegiac moment in them. You know, like, you,
yes.
you know, you, you, you don't get to have a mammy anymore, but you can eat like one. Definitely. You know, that kind of thing. Whereas in the German case, it's entirely different.
That is entirely different. It's entirely different. And I know that American historians who've worked on this have you know, found all sorts of explanations for why there's this huge surge in American advertising and popular culture, you know, starting in the 1870s, and especially really taking off in the 1890s, 1900, with all these figures, Aunt Jemima, you know, Uncle Ben, you know, Rastus, the cream of wheat. All of these figures. And there's lithographs in the U.S. from the 1870s, the Darktown lithographs, right? And there's this whole series of collectible lithographs about the bumbling incompetence of Black Americans. But you're exactly right. Interwoven into all of that imagery is almost a bucolic idealism, mm-hmm. An idea that this is, you know, it's a post-slavery moment, but American historians of the United States have talked about how this is in some ways sanitizing slavery. At the same time, it's sort of reinventing, you know, it's this post-slavery, but at the same time, it's reinventing slavery in a much more peaceful, idyllic context.
Yeah, I mean, in Gone with the Wind, the mammy, I don't remember what her name was, but she's the most sympathetic character in the whole thing.
Oh, definitely.
She's definitely the smartest person.
Exactly. And the idea of, you know, I've read in the work of American historians that, it's comforting for, a lower middle class or middle class mother to, you know, in the kitchen to have, you know, this almost iconic, you know, African-American serving woman there on her cereal box or there on her, you know, syrup or whatnot, and there's all sorts of things going into that. And what's fascinating to me is the way the Germans borrow that, and they borrow it without really understanding it, and they borrow it through so many different avenues.
Yeah, let's talk about those avenues a little bit, let's talk a little bit about the origins of this in Germany, because I want to start a little earlier than. These sort of borrowings from American culture, if that's what they are. There's something that you mentioned in the book that I was unaware of, and I've looked at a lot of these woodcuts and things, and that is the tobacco moor.
Yes.
And I want you to talk about that, because in American culture, we have the sometimes called the drugstore Indian or the tobacco Indian, right? You know, this is a wooden Indian. And the association there is pretty clear, you know. So tobacco is a New World product, and the Indians introduced it to the white folks, and so that's what's going on there. But the tobacco moor, that just is confusing to me.
Well, it's actually confusing to everyone. I think no one really knows what to make of it. I've traced it mostly as it circulates in German, in Germany and in German sort of, I guess you'd call it mercantile, sort of pre-commercial, sort of mercantile woodcuts and other sorts of imagery. But it's probably, I'm a little on a limb here, but I think it probably emerges first in Britain, because in Britain, the figure's called the Blackamoor.
Oh, really? Okay. Yeah.
So it's the Blackamoor in Britain, the Tabakmoor in German, the Tabakmoor in Dutch and whatnot. And it's very closely associated with that first wave of colonial... of colonies with the Dutch and the English bringing tobacco over from, you know, well, the Dutch not so much, the Dutch bringing it over, you know, shipping it over, but the English, you know, producing it in Virginia and whatnot. And they're first marking these tobacco sacks that are coming from, you know, the 13 colonies, or, you know, coming from the New World colonies. They're marking the tobacco sacks with these, they're sort of almost like a guild symbol, but it's a post-guild evolution, if you want to talk about it that way. And they're using them as a marker of exotic origin, almost a provenance of exotic origin. Uh-huh. So how do you know your tobacco is actually coming from, you know, Virginia or the New World? It's not even really Virginia yet. Well, you know, because the sack actually has this black figure of exoticism sewn on it.
Right.
And then... There's a lot of imitation going on, and so then all of these Dutch tobacco merchants are crafting these very similar looking to each other images, but all slightly different, and they have this almost nebulous exoticism associated with them. So you could have the same figure, and one is has, you know, is at, it has, you know, the label Virginia, And the exact same figure, which is a, you know, stark black figure with, you know, a tobacco leaf skirt, would have the name African and would be riding an elephant. And so the symbol becomes almost a generic is not quite the right word.
Becomes stereotyped.
It's not a stereotype. It's not, and because I'm, I have to, one of the things I struggle with this book is very precise use of, evocative language. It's an evocative symbol, it's a universal symbol of exotic origins. Mm-hmm. And the odd thing is the universality of this comes in part because of technology, the printing technology, of putting imagery into something in the 16th or 17th century. You're talking about adding an image to a classified ad. Of course, you have, you know, typeset for the letters, but for the image, you actually have to carve.
Yeah, it's expensive.
It's expensive.
Yeah.
And the woodblocks have to be cheap, and you have to stamp them out. And they only last so
long. Yeah, they don't last very long. Yeah, you don't.
Exactly.
I studied this intensively. They do not last long.
Exactly. So you see a flexibility where these same figures are repatterned through different things. So, for example, in the United States, I've seen the tobacco or more image, the exact same image is being used to sell slaves. Uh-huh. And it's being used as a sort of an eye-catching thing in 17th century, 18th century classified ads to sell slaves. And the same, basically the virtually same image in Britain is the blackamoor being used to sell tobacco. In the Dutch Netherlands and Germany, being used to sell tobacco also.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I have a quick question about the word Moor.
Yes.
Okay. So, in my understanding, which is very primitive, Moor is a Muslim from North Africa.
Yes.
That's what I understand it as. Now, did people in let's say early 19th century Germany or late 18th century Germany, when this thing, you know, sort of begins to appear, did they just think of a Moor as a black person?
Yes.
Was that, they didn't have Schwarze? I don't know. What did they just say, Moor, and that meant black person? And
Definitely. And in fact, there's a fantastic book in German, Schwarze Moor edel Teufel. The other way around. Schwarze Teufel edel Moor. And which basically, black devil, noble Moor. Mm-hmm. But the Moor is definitely, the figure of the Moor in Germany goes all the way back, basically biblical times, in German. Iconography in the 13th medieval iconography, 13th century. One of the three wise men was often figured as a black figure, as a Moor, it represented the three wise men represented the three continents:
right.
Europe, Asia, and Africa. And so Moors, from the Crusades onwards, Moorenkopf, the Moor's head. This is a standard medieval. Heraldic symbol.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, so Moors are definitely, in Germany in particular, sort of a generic figure of exotified blackness.
Yeah, I got it. Okay. But it has nothing to do with being Muslim, really. Nothing directly.
Well, it comes out of the Crusades originally.
Uh-huh.
And there's an assumption, the Moor of Venice or whatever, there's an assumption that there is some sort of, connection to Islam. But that fades.
Okay.
That fades.
Yeah, right. Okay. Yeah, that confused me too, so I'm glad you cleared that up.
Sure.
Okay, so where were we? Now, we have these basically, one of the things that reminded me of, I just have to say this, is that when paper began to be produced en masse in the 16th century, really, there was a proliferation of what were really trademarks for paper producers, and their whole books of them, their watermarks.
Yes.
So, like, one of the stereotyped ones is the fool's head.
Yeah.
There are like 150 kinds of fool's heads, right? All borrowed from one another. And people were basically knocking off each other's paper. Did you say they had these fool's head? And it's a kind of similar sort of thing, because as you show in the book, if our audience reads the book, and I hope they do, you'll see that you see one image from, the 17th century and then one from the 18th century and then the 19th century. And the only difference is they get clearer. the art's better, but they're the same image.
Definitely. And one thing I found is that when I'm starting in the beginning of the 20th century, the end of the 19th century, and then I'm trying to trace this imagery back, they have these lineages that sort of twist backwards through multiple origins and back centuries. At the same time, the image itself, and this is, I think, a really important argument in my book, the images themselves, the function of the images change over time.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think, is that's what separates the stereotype of the modern age, the mass reproduced image, from the sort of the allegorical generic figure of the 18th century.
Yeah, but before we get to that, and I want to focus on that. But what did Germans actually know about Africans in the, let's say, before the late 19th century? Were there any Africans in Germany? I mean, did they know anything about Africa?
There were actually there's some really interesting work being done by historians about Africans who came to Germany and basically the roots of, because there is a small Afro-German community now, and the ancient roots of this, not ancient, but the centuries old roots of this Afro-German community. But yeah, there were, you know, Germany, the Prussia was briefly involved in the slave trade and briefly had a colony on the west coast of Africa in the 16th century. And there were, Moors, in quotations, that came to Germany, sometimes purchased as slaves, mm-hmm. Sometimes, you know, wound up there. And, you know, like Frederick the Great, you know, had a Moorish band leader, for instance. I mean, there's all sorts of, and of course, the port cities, Bremen and Hamburg. In the 18th century, you know, bring in, you know, all sorts of people from all sorts of places, mm-hmm. including people from North Africa and Sub-Saharan Africa. Mm-hmm. But with all, so there is a little bit of, there are some people of either Northern African or even some of Sub-Saharan African descent in Germany. Mm-hmm. But the numbers are very small. Mm-hmm. And I think it's more that what sort of Africa represents to Germany in the 17th and 18th century. I'm a little out of my century here, but I think it's safe to say that there's an exotic element. There's an other element, mm-hmm. But it's definitely the figure of you know, Africa in the imagination of 18th century Germans is this almost impossibly fantastic land.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And this changes in 19th century. It changes rather quickly.
Mm-hmm.
As the Germans read, especially, they pick up a lot of travel writing, you know, by British explorers at mid-century, and these are translated into German, and then German explorers go there. And so by the 1870s, 1880s, Germans are very, even before Germany gets their own colonial empire, German travel writers and ethnographers and sort of amateur scientists are very much, you know, missionaries are all in Africa, you know, working, you know, either on their own or else part of the British imperial system.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about the meaning of the images and the images themselves. So you've got us to the point where there are these, you know, I would call them kind of identification marks for certain products, especially
yes.
tobacco and coffee. But
yes.
but this is before the era of mass image advertising.
Yes.
So that era starts in the 1890s, is that right?
Definitely.
Okay. So why don't you talk a little bit about that and how these images of the tobacco moor and so on and so forth kind of filter into and are selected by and then elaborated into, you know, really quite stylized artistic productions in the 1890s and what they mean.
Sure. I'd be happy to. Yeah, the 1890s is a really pivotal moment for basically the birth of advertising in Germany and in the 1880s, you know, in Britain and the United States as well. And one of the things, just to back up just a little bit, Marshall, one of the things I first noticed when I started reading histories of German advertising written by Germans in the 1920s or even in the 1900s, is they always claim that advertising is ancient. You know, advertising goes this ancient lineage. It goes back to the very first, you know, language when the very first cavemen, they don't use the word cavemen.
Yeah.
When the very first, an ancient Mesopotamia, he shouts out his wares, you know, come buy my wares. And they all try and see this ancient lineage of advertising. But the thing that I really want to emphasize most is the idea and images and, you know, these markers, you know, guild marks and, you know, allegorical symbols and these watermarks that, you know, are talking about, these tobacco moors. These are all associated with, you know, some form of, you know, merchandising or commerce or whatnot, as trademarks, as symbols, as identifier marks, you know, things like that. But the idea that a picture, a visual image should actually sell a product, The image itself should somehow make the argument, make the claim, make the forceful claim on your attention that you would then purchase this product because of the image or because of the promise in the image. That is startlingly new. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's the core of our culture today. I mean, I think advertising makes up, you know, the core of Western mm-hmm. cultures, particularly the United States. And it's so easy for us to overlook how startlingly new that is. But that really comes into Germany in the 1880s and 1890s, especially the 1890s. And one of the things, the first advertisers, so they have this new technology. They have, lithographic print technologies advanced to the point where images have become cheaper and cheaper and cheaper to reproduce. And they have sort of a booming economy and they have sort of a spirit, you know, there's an air of entrepreneurial, you know, and there's new products coming in from all over the world. And so this is a really time of economic ferment. And German advertisers then are, they have to, in some ways, they drift into using images more and more, in a more and more alluring fashion, more and more provocative fashion, and provocative meaning sort of reach out and sort of grab hold of the passerby and seize attention. And this is all, of course, tied up with, you know, mass reproduction, urban, you know, of images, but also of goods, urbanization. You know, there's all sorts of economic, social, physical, spatial, you know, things going on here that are all tightly tied together, and it's hard to separate them out. But in the midst of all this, what advertisers have to do is sell themselves, and they have to sell themselves to Germans, to mm-hmm. Germans. And they have to, because this was not something that was being done. In fact, there are all sorts of, recent advertising histories of Germany, like that of Lamberti and whatnot, talk about how advertisers face opposition. For one thing, you know, the idea of using imagery to sell goods and to promote goods, you know, in an overly aggressive fashion is declass A. You know, it's something you do with patent medicine. And we even have that phrase, you know, the same thing in the U.S., you know, patent medicine huckster, right? You know, like P.T. Barnum, right? There's something a little bit distasteful about the sort of over-the-top promotion of the patent medicines, you know, in the 1870s and 1880s. Well, in Germany, it's like that, but even more so. And so the advertisers have to establish themselves. And one of the ways they do this is, as I mentioned before, they talk about themselves as artists and as professionals. But they also talk about themselves as, on the one hand, importing ideas, modern ideas, modernity from the United States and from Great Britain. And on the other hand, pulling on these age-old German themes. And so an advertiser who's crafting a tobacco ad in 1890 can look to the tobacco war, use that same notion that somehow tobacco was associated with a black figure, you know, a century ago, when you would buy your tobacco from your local tobacconist. But now you can, you know, with the new technology, you can wrap the product, you wrap the tobacco tin in imagery, you can wrap the, you can have a poster, you know, showing the image of the figure, you know, posted in a train station so everyone is seeing this image. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you know, you want to have a certain sense of resonance. And so by drawing on this figure of the tobacco moor and then changing it, updating it, incorporating new elements, incorporating a much more vivid depiction, incorporating a visually arresting a style of presentation. And the second half of my book is all about this visual process, because it's interesting. Advertisers don't talk about these visual processes nearly as much as they talk about, you know, their own expertise. But you see them happening. When you mm-hmm. actually trace, and that's why there's really three components to my book. There's the advertising component, the imperialism component, and then the visual component. Visuality almost has a life of its own. It's mm-hmm. decentralized in its production, its strategies of visuality emerge, not because advertisers are promoting them, but because they work. And they, you know, I've used that word in quotations, but they're seen to be powerful. Mm-hmm. And so you can reconfigure an image of the tobacco moor into a colonial context. So the tobacco moor is this generic figure of exoticism, but wait, instead we're going to have an African figure carrying the tobacco on his head to you, the consumer. And this is a much more visually arresting image. And it's also an image of power. It flatters the consumer. You know, here is your servant being trade to you on a poster bringing you your tobacco from the German colonies, mm-hmm. even though the tobacco is bought, you know, in Amsterdam, you know, mm-hmm. from the United States. Mm-hmm. So there's a way that the colonial, in this moment, 1890 to 1900, the colonial terrain of Africa really becomes a way to repattern old images, remake them in more powerful, more visually arresting ways.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I see. So one question I had was, you point out in the book, on the one hand, that there is this attention paid by advertisers and the people who buy advertising to both this tradition of something like the tobacco moor, the images of Africans in what's called trademarking or branding. And, mm-hmm. and these images do spread and they mm-hmm. become more well wrought. Let's put it that way. They are actually quite artistic at a certain point, as yes. off-putting as they may be to us. They are yep. rendered well. But on the other hand, you point out that Germans are actually quite ambivalent about imperialism. They don't really like it so much. I mean, they're inner regarding. They're not as excited about Southwest yeah. Africa.
Yes, that's true. And here's where I have to sort of be a little bit of a splitter and basically make distinctions that, you know, you have, of course, the colonial enthusiasts, the members of the German Colonial Society, where Germany's colonies are the be all and end all. And they're the ones who in histories that deal with German colonialism, they get all the attention because they're the loudest. But even they complain. That sort of German society is too, you know, uninterested in the colonial question. That's sort of their perspective and their own interpretation. But I think it's safe to say that most Germans, in the 1890s, are not terribly interested in the idea of colonies and the practice of colonies. You know, they have their attention, you know, captured by a little bit of, ethnographic show here, like these people shows, which I can talk about later on if you like. Or they have their attention captured by a colonial society sponsored exhibition, or maybe they see an article in the newspaper about unsere neue Landesleute, our new country people in East Africa or whatnot. But for the most part, there's not a lot of interest in it, and partly, I mean, there's some economic reasons here too that the German colonies never produce economically. Mm-hmm. They're for the most part, with a few exceptions. They're actually a loss. They're a drain on the German national treasury. Mm-hmm. It's not like the German colonies in Africa are never like India is for Britain. Mm-hmm. You know, it's never this enormous generator of wealth and also of prestige. Mm-hmm. And of course, the British, cultivate their own sense of prestige from India and really rebroadcast you know, themselves as imperialists because they have this great, you know, wealth generated in India. So there's a way that economics and culture really are always working in tandem with each other. Mm-hmm. But in Germany, there's not that economic thing going on. So you have the politicized colonialists who are sort of loudly proclaiming, Germany's need to colonize. And you have there isn't really no economy of colonialism that really is working. Mm-hmm. Germans are getting all of their cocoa from, you know, places in South America, like Ecuador, mm-hmm. and they're getting tobacco from the Southern United States, you know? So there's not a way to connect economically with Germans. And what finally captures attention, in Germany, of the German public, my book argues, is war. Mm-hmm. And it's the first, you know, there's the this, when the Germans seize the city of Kaohsiung, which is currently in Jiaozu, which is a city on the coast of China. This is this moment that's celebrated in the mass media. And then advertisers pick up on the sort of jingoistic seizing of this Chinese colony, and then advertisers themselves play on it and reinforce it at the same time. And then the Boer War in South Africa between the British and the Boers over the fate of South Africa. This also is seized upon by the new mass media in Germany. Again, you have to think of advertising and the mass media very much in harmony with each other. Mm-hmm. The new, just recently emerging mass media, you know, newspapers being pitched to a much broader audience. The newspapers need to sell more newspapers. The price of the newspaper is lowered because the advertisements in the newspaper make the newspaper more affordable, so the circulation can expand, so the audience can expand. So there's sort of a chicken and egg thing going on, or a mutually reinforcing cycle thing going on here.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. See, I was trying to think of an American parallel because Americans are, I would say, I think many of my colleagues would disagree, that Americans are extraordinarily ambivalent about, let's say, overseas adventures or imperialism. Although for some reason our colleagues are always saying that we have an empire. I don't know how that can be, but in any event, American imperialism, whatever that is, I don't know if I've ever met an American who wants to build an empire. But anyway, I was trying to think, you know, there are racist images of Filipinos, for example, and, you know, they're Cuban cigars and things like that. But I really can't think of any example. You certainly are not going to sell anything by saying it comes from Iraq today in the United States. You're just not going to. So I guess I kind of
– But Cuba is an interesting point there because the Cuban cigar packages – originally produced in Cuba. And so there's a sort of this moment of sort of self-produced exoticism where Cuban, you know, are producing their own incredibly beautiful chromolithographed cigar tins, exporting them all over the world. Same thing happens in Germany with the Egyptian cigarette market. Egyptians are producing these incredibly gorgeous tins to keep their cigarettes in. And then the Germans, you know, come to associate, you know, the exoticism of a cigarette with, you know, with Egypt. And so, you know, Americans and Germans both tend to associate the exoticism of the cigar with Cuba. And these are all in some ways almost initially they're self-promoted images.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There was a thread that we picked up and then dropped a few months ago, but I want to come back to it. And that is the influence or not of American cultural and particularly American minstrel shows on this stuff.
Yes. Well, one of the startling things, I'm going to have to work backwards just a little bit here. And unfortunately, you can't do this over the radio or the podcast, but I have to sort of describe the images.
Yeah, no, it's so, tough. Yeah. I know.
And it is, you know, images worth 1,000 words, so it might take me 1,000 words to get.
Well, actually, we might be able to put some of the images up on the website. We'll see if we can do that.
Okay, sounds good. But one of the things that I noticed, again, sort of working backwards as I'm flipping page by page through these trademark registrations and digging through museum collections and you know, going through professional advertising journals and whatnot, I'm noticing that right around 1900, just and especially 1903, 1904, the images of Africans start to get a lot more racist. And it's an imprecise word, racist, but what I mean by that is there's more graphic emphasis placed on the differentiation of the racial features.
Mm-hmm.
So their lips get larger, their stature gets smaller, their ears get bigger, their eyes get bigger. And this is uniformly across. I mean, it starts out in fits and starts, but by 1910, it's completely uniform. And so I wanted to know, where does this come from? And that's where I start to trace different things back. And of course, there's a tradition of caricature in Germany. With Wilhelm Busch, you know, in the 1880s, even before that, and then they get Busch's work gets really popular in the 1880s. But one of the things that I hit upon, I'm seeing that this first wave of German racially inspired advertising is all having with not depictions of Africans, but depictions of African Americans. And there's really two paths that these come to Germany. And one I can talk about later is on American products like toothpaste and things like that. But even before then, we see German poster advertisers as early as the 1880s, or poster designers in the 1880s, crafting posters in Germany for American minstrel shows, and they're using this incredibly racialized, this heightened graphic depiction of racialization because it's totally suitable for the minstrel show. The minstrel show is a over the top, you know, depiction of, you know, of race. Right. And these minstrel shows, these in the 1880s, these American minstrel shows are touring Germany. They first tour Britain and then they go on to the continent and they're touring Germany. And there's a way that these minstrel shows become a sensation in Germany. Now, I don't think they're necessarily understood. and the reason why I say that is for two reasons. One is at the same time you have these minstrel shows, which are, you know, white Americans for the most part, and then sometimes black Americans too, later on, especially, putting on blackface and acting out, you know, an exaggerated depiction of, you know, life in, you know, the racialized South or, you know, in the North or what have you. You have this exaggerated depiction, this comic over the top, depiction of race that's circulating in Germany. At the same time, you have all these other people shows, like the Karl Hagenbeck and some of these other entrepreneurs are bringing, you know, real live natives from Tierra del Fuego, or from Australia, or from other places, and bringing them to Germany and showing them as a sort of a national, as a living National Geographic, right? Here we're having people perform their own culture. And the minstrel shows arrive in Germany at the exact same time that these other groups of quote-unquote natives are also being portrayed as authentic peoples of nature. So you have these two sort of shows swirling around themselves, swirling around Germany. And I think it's pretty safe to say, I don't think the Germans necessarily recognize the over-the-top racial caricature of the minstrel show. And I saw one, I stumbled across one amazing story where in the 1880s in Hamburg, they actually arrest a minstrel show. There's actually, the police are called out and they arrest the performers because the German audience figures out that these aren't real blacks, that these are white people with corked up faces. And they're furious. They think they've been scammed. And, you know, we came here to see real American blacks performing their culture. And here you're giving us a bunch of white people who are corked up and exaggerating. And of course, the thing is all smoothed over pretty quickly. But so the shows themselves become popular. And they become popular in part also, and just to go back again, sort of lineages, everything goes back to something before. You know, Uncle Tom's Cabin is a bestseller in Germany. And then after the minstrel shows, then there's the cakewalk craze that circulates through Germany. And there's all sorts of, there's a series, periodic waves of things coming from the U.S., you know, and that's, you know, jazz in the 20s and then, you know, rap, you know, in the 80s. So there's so in this particular moment, then the minstrel show is the craze. And then the poster designers incorporate these exaggerated caricatures in the 1880s, and then they make their way onto other depictions of blacks later on, a decade or two later.
Mm-hmm. I see.
So that's the first. That's one lineage. It's, you know, everything is sort of has multiple origins, but the minstrel show is definitely one origin for German racial. The minstrel show posters of the 1880s and 1890s are one origin for the racialized advertising of 1910.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, near the end of your book, you present a thesis about a transformation or change in what these images mean for Germans. It moves from a kind of a representation of the exotic, something that's very different, certainly something that is inferior to, but something still appealing in these images, to something that's quite different. And it's bound up with what I guess what we'd call scientific racism, and also a certain certain defensiveness on the Germans' part. They begin to think that they are beset, and this will have really dire consequences a couple of times in the 20th century. So, if you could talk just a little bit about that, that would be great.
Sure thing. I'm happy to. Definitely. Yes, definitely. There is a change in the way these images are formed in the universality and in the context they appear in. And just to back up just a little bit, one of the things that we see between 1900 and 1910 is that the images are increasingly of Africans and are both increasingly racialized in the ways that I've just described with larger lips and diminished figure, but they're also increasingly placed in positions of inferiority vis-a-vis the product. So, and it's a way for advertisers to show prominence, the power of the product. And this is done optically. By optically, I mean it's done with scale. So you have the giant, you know, the margarine container, which is really the size of a hand, is suddenly blown up to enormous size. Mm-hmm. And the caricatured Africans are shouldering it, carrying the margarine, or they're beneath the margarine or they're around the margarine and worshiping it. There's all sorts of different ways. But the power relationship is set up in the advertisement so that the figure in, so that the product is displayed and the grandness, the power of the product is displayed by the inferiority of the accompanying figure. And Africans are incredibly useful for this because there's many other images that are circulated in German advertising, images of, you know, the pale white woman who's selling soap. Or the maternal figure, you know, the more, you know, full figured maternal figure who's, you know, feeding, you know, cocoa to her, you know, cherubic children, you know, or the thin white man who's wearing the modern suit. You know, I mean, there are other images there, too. But especially women and children are the main sort of white women and white children are the other two main iconic figures. Mm-hmm. But the African figure is more useful than they are, because you can really put in Germany, that doesn't have a large African minority there at the time. You can diminish the figure more. You can humiliate the figure more in the picture, and thus extol the product more visually. And advertisers do that more and more and more, and they do that in increasingly hegemonic ways, so that by 1910, all images of Africans in advertising are small, diminished, and in a position of inferiority to this product, in a way of selling the product.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I then jump to the context of the image. And that's where, you know, the context of a mass-reproduced stereotype is enormously different from that of a tobacco moor. Because a tobacco moor, you know, you see it maybe once or twice, you know, at your tobacconists. Whereas these mass-reproduced imagery that now looks all alike, because the advertisers are all imitating each other, is everywhere. Mm-hmm. And it's in every magazine, it's on posters everywhere, and the figures are all sort of universally done in that way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the African figure is also useful in one additional way, not just to diminish it to promote the grandness of the commodity, but also to appeal to a wider audience. So you have, you know, Germany in the 1890s, 1900s, an incredibly class stratified society. You have aristocrats, you have, you know, middle class lawyers, you have working class, you have the socialist movement is, you know, socialist party. In Germany, by 1900, 1905, is the largest political
big.
Party. Yeah. Oh, it's the largest political
very
party,
big.
Right? Yeah. It's massive. The socialists are well organized. The middle class Germans are increasingly anxious about you know, these sort of rough around the edges workers becoming political. And this is the era of growing mass politics. And this presents a huge dilemma to advertisers, because let's say you're going to advertise you're trying to advertise a cigarette or something. Do you pitch it with imagery that will appeal only to the middle class, in which case they can afford it and they can buy it, but you're going to lose this huge pool of potential, you know, working class purchasers?
Mm-hmm.
Or do you pitch the image so that it appeals to the working class and then the middle class feels like it's a little bit declassé?
Mm-hmm.
So advertisers, they needed a generic consumer. They needed the idea of a German who just bought things to have to consume things.
Mm-hmm.
And this figure doesn't really exist in Germany. You know, the culture is so, even consumption is so wrapped up in class. You know, middle class people smoke cigars. You know, working class people drink beer in the middle class. But, you know, there's all sorts of, you know, class oriented consumptions going on. One of the useful things about an African figure is that in a visual realm, like when you actually print it out on a piece of paper, you can, the blackness of the figure starkly differentiates itself from any white figures in there.
Mm-hmm.
So in my book, for example, has the Kokoza Moor, which is this caricatured, stark, pitch black figure that is offering to a group of German children the Kokoza margarine.
Mm-hmm.
And the German children, when you look closely, they're all a little bit different. I mean, they all look sort of, you know, kind of generic children. But it's much more difficult to see distinctions between the children. You know, what are they wearing? Are they middle class? Are they working class? Well, you know, in Germany, you know, in 1907, you can tell immediately what class someone is by the clothes. But in the advertisement, it's very difficult to see what clothes they're wearing, because this stark black figure is such a visual contrast to them. So, again, this is very difficult to articulate verbally, much more easier to show visually.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a way in which the stark chromatic contrast of blackness is useful in advertising, in hiding differences amongst the white figures. And so in this very visual way, and then also all sorts of intellectual and other ways as well, the idea of racial difference, of the Africans as a race apart, builds the idea of a coherent German. I mean, helps to mm-hmm. Germans to imagine themselves as a coherent, you know, no, I'm not a middle-class person from Hamburg. I'm a German. I know I'm a German because I see this African there.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, a lot of people have worked on identity being constructed in stark contrast. You know, I know I'm German because rather than a Württemberger because the person across the border is French. So there's a way in which we historians have really investigated how identity is constructed. National identities are often constructed antagonistically to each other. And historians of imperialism talked about how national identities are often constructed imperialistically, in terms of racial contrast to each other, and the British imagine themselves as British rather than Scottish or English or Welsh, mm-hmm. Because, they're not black, they're not Indian, they're not. Well, there's a way in which advertising works in this same context as mm-hmm. well. But the promoting not a German nationalist, who hates the French, or a British, a British identity of who's responsible for the civilizing mission, who will uplift the lower races, but rather a generic German consumer.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask one final question before I ask what you're working on now. It's kind of a trick question. Culture is tenacious, yes. And it tends to stick around even when we think it's gone. Is any of this left in Germany now?
Oh yes. Oh my God. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Go ahead.
The most famous. My book ends basically with the construction, the image of the Zarate Moor, and any German, every single German you'll ever talk to has heard of the Zarate Moor. It's probably one of the most famous commercial icons, commercial stereotype icons, and it's a caricatured black figure in Oriental, in harem pants mm-hmm. and a fluffy hat, and it sells Zarate chocolate. And has sold Zarate chocolate since 1917. Mm-hmm. And it's very much at the tail end of this development. So this figure incorporates all these things. Well, the Zarate Moor is beloved, this beloved icon, sort of like an Aunt Jemima, but even more prevalent in Germany, all the way up through, the 60s and 70s. Mm-hmm. And in fact, when I was, in Germany, and they still, the Zarate still sometimes sponsors. I mean, they might have, I've eased up on this in the last five years or so, but 10 years ago, I definitely saw, sort of people dressing up in blackface and dressing themselves up as the Zarate Moor with these huge caricatured lips and everything, something that would be completely unacceptable in the United States. And many Germans not realizing that this is actually, a little bit, anyway. But there's also all sorts of other ways. So, Zarate Moor is one example, but there's also other ways, Negerküsse, these Negro kisses, or these treats that you can buy. There's ways in which the imprint of this a racialized consumption that comes from the Kaiserreich is still very much in evidence in many parts of Germany. Although that's changing, and that's changing with globalization.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. No, I was thinking, and this is a sort of aside.
No, go ahead.
If you watch sort of highbrow German films.
Yes.
That in any way involve Americans or American, you would think that about 50% of Americans were black. Because there is always a black character. In every one of these films, there's always a black character. Except half of the characters are black. And I never understand it, but they really fixate on this. It's an interesting thing. Yeah, but I mean, the other thing to say is Aunt Jemima is still around. So is Uncle Ben.
Okay. Oh yeah, no. That's
you can go to your local supermarket and sing him.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Yeah,
but an African American friend of mine who was in Berlin, she at the same time I was. She talked about how incredibly different it was to be black in Germany today than it is to be black in the United States. And it has its own costs.
It's
very much constantly being sort of exotified.
Yeah.
And, she said to me at one point very directly, consumed in an odd way, not feared, but sort of consumed.
I hear it's the same way in Japan with very tall people. I'm 6'4", and I'm going to Japan next summer, and I'm told that people will walk up to me and want to take pictures of me. I can't wait.
I could completely imagine.
Someone could be a giant, and he's 6'4". Wow, look at that. Look at that weirdo. Anyway, I don't mind. It's okay, because I am kind of a weirdo. So anyway, let me close the interview by asking our traditional final question on New Books in History, and that is, what are you working on now?
Oh, well, I'm working on two very different projects. One is my more immediate project is a book, Selling War. And if the first book looked at blackness in German culture, the second book will look at whiteness in German culture, and a specific branch of whiteness, a specific thread of whiteness, if you will, sort of a militarized whiteness. So one of the things this book is grappling with is, what role did advertising play in constructing visions of white Germans before the First World War? How did advertising morph into propaganda? Because there's all sorts of really interesting things going on where you see direct personnel transfers. You know, graphic designers who had been working in consumer culture in 1912 are basically knocking on the doors of government in 1916, please give us a job. We are the master manipulators. We can manipulate the psyche of the Germans and so they can win the war. Please pay us because there's more consumer economy. And so what is the relationship between advertising and propaganda? What's the what is the relationship between advertising and militarism, particularly leading up to the war? And then the third part of this project is, and how does this play into the imagery of fascism? And, you know, Susan Sontag and others have wrote, you know, very provocatively on that there is a recognizable fascist image. And what I want to do is I want to sort of unpack that a little bit and do what I did in the first book and sort of trace backwards and see, you know, is there, you know, what is a fascist image identity look like? Can it be unpacked? Can it, how much does it relate to advertising? How much does it relate to propaganda and that sort of thing? So that's one project I have. And the other project is one that I've probably been working on a long time, but it's a labor of love, and it's the image of the banana in German culture.
You gotta be kidding me.
I'm not kidding.
The banana.
I kid you not.
The banana. Okay. All right, peel that back for us.
and it's a four-stage project, a four moment project. You know, the first moment is in the 1880s, 1890s. Because one of the things I was doing when I was tracing this book is I was digging through all these grocers' journals.
Yeah.
So I found all this fantastic evidence about, you know, when the banana first comes to Germany, you know, coming from South America, Latin and Central and South America on steamships. It's hailed in Germany as this wonder food. So I have all these fantastic sources talking about, okay, this is a banana. You don't, you know, these are signs in store windows. This is a banana. You do not eat the peel. You do not need to cook it. It's wonderful, nutritious. And at the same time, I have some of these colonialists who are going to German industrials and saying, look, this banana is this great wonder food. We need to have colonies that produce bananas. Because if we can have cheap bananas in Germany, we can feed them to the workers. The workers can live off of bananas just like the apes in Africa do.
Oh, yeah.
And if they live entirely off of this wonder food, the banana, you can cut wages and your profits will skyrocket.
Mm-hmm.
So that's this moment of the 1880s, 1890s, where banana is this symbol for the potential, the unrealized potential of the imperial economy, of the colonial. Mm-hmm. With all of its racist
banana engine of imperialism.
Exactly. Then the 1920s, of course, is Josephine Baker with her famous banana dance. And that's tied into an entirely different thing. The banana has become, of course, eroticized in the Freudian sense, but also it's now this sort of more generic tropical thing, you know.
I don't have any idea what you mean about eroticized in the Freudian sense. Can you explain that a little bit? I don't know what you're talking about. No, go ahead.
So Adolf Hitler pursuing autarky, you know, it says right. Points, you know, Germans don't need bananas. We're not apes. We're not, you know, we're not right. Monkeys. And there's a sort of racialized autarky that's in Hitler's mind. And then the final moment, of course, in 1989, when the wall comes down, the banana is the symbol of deprivation for East Germans. So when East Berliners pour into West Berlin, shops in West, they have no money, at least at first. They can't buy anything. They're just basically looking. West Berliners buy batches and batches of bananas and hand bananas to East Germans coming in to the stores as a sort of a welcome to the West. Here's the forbidden fruit.
And in fact,
I've read claims that banana was rather than the apple was in fact the original forbidden fruit. That's still a little bit. Umstritten, as the Germans would say.
I don't know what to say about that. I know that in the Russian case, they have a kind of thing about oranges, not so much bananas. I don't know if they ever had bananas in the Soviet Union, but they must have had bananas. But I know that in the old Soviet Union, when oranges showed up, that was a sign that everything was right with the world. Right. They very rarely showed up. And they were always from Egypt. But right. Oranges were like a really big deal. Oranges, yeah. So it sounds like a very interesting project to me. I was thinking about the fascist aesthetic in your first project. If anybody listening to this show lives in Washington, D.C., they can go see what it is. Just go down to the mall and look at the federal architecture. There it is. I mean, there are no better examples of it right down there.
Madison, Wisconsin has a beautiful fascist building built in the 1930s.
Yeah, so it's not – yeah, you don't really go far to see it. So anyway, David, it's really been a pleasure talking to you today. Thanks for being on the show.
I don't mind, Marshall. Thank you
so
much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to an interview with David Chiarlo about his award-winning book, Advertising Empire, Race and Visual Culture in Imperial Germany. I'm Marshall Poe, the host of New Books in History. I hope you have a great week.